Father, we want to praise you for another beautiful day, for the west wind and the leaves and all their colour just blowing here and there. We thank you that every aspect of the creation speaks to us of its being designed and being full of order and beauty and meaning. Father, we thank you that we do live in a world that we know is created, that we're not in a world which is uncertain and meaningless, which is going nowhere and has come from nowhere. But we thank you, Father, that we live before you, the eternal and true God, our Creator and our Redeemer. We ask that you'll be with us in this class hour together, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Well, let's start on this next article, which is the one on the Christian and modern art. This was from the Bible Today. I think I gave you all a copy of it in March 1951. And I found it very interesting reading this article. It's the first thing of his I've come across that he wrote where he talks about the arts in any detail. We have a couple of references already in one or two of these other example articles that we've looked at. But if we just recall where he's come from in this area, remember, in his own background, he had had no encouragement to be interested in the arts from his family or from his early education. His interest was really sparked by Edith, whose own family background was very different. There was much more of a delight in artistic things. It really grew into life, one could say. Really began to grow and take form on his first trip to Europe, where as he went around visiting Christians all over Europe after the war in 1947, finding out the state of the churches there, every spare minute he had, he went to churches, he went to cathedrals, he went to museums, he went to look at paintings and sculptures and so on all over Europe, and just enjoyed himself enormously. And then it was spurred on and informed by his meeting with Hans Rückmacher. You remember we said that he met Rückmacher in Holland at the first gathering of the International Council of Christian Churches in 1948, when they came back to live in Europe. When they were on their way to Switzerland, they stopped off, you remember, for a few weeks in Holland, and he was meeting Rückmacher every day there. Rückmacher was at that time a young art critic, and later to be professor of art history at the University of Amsterdam, and wrote several books on art. But Rückmacher, he and Rückmacher discussed a lot together. You'll notice in this article he in fact acknowledges his debt to Rückmacher very early on. He says that in writing on art, I acknowledge with pleasure the stimulating conversations I've had on this subject with a young Christian art critic of Amsterdam, A.M. Rückmacher. It's on page 163 there in the first column. So he's had a growing interest in the arts. Now, what is the thesis of this article? The thesis is that there is no better way to understand the basic worldview of a period of history than to study its art forms. That's his thesis. A thesis which was going to become one of the major themes of his teaching through the next years. But here it's first formally stated. There is no better way to understand the basic worldview of a period of history than to study its art forms. What he's saying simply is that art is not created in a vacuum. You don't just have somebody who has a gift of painting or a gift of music and who just goes out and paints. That what people paint reflects the period in which they live, reflects the worldview of the period in which they live. That, in a way, the arts reflect it better than anybody else. They often tell you which direction it's going in, because they're people who are reflecting of and expressing with their creativity what is beginning to happen in the world around them. And this is important. When you see a picture, a painting, I think we often tend to just look at paintings or listen to music as if they were written in a vacuum. But if you stop and think for one moment, this is nonsense. As soon as you begin to know anything about art, you can look at a painting or listen to a piece of music and say, that piece of music was written in India, for example, because it's so totally different from Western music. Let's use that as a rather crude illustration. Or that that piece of art clearly comes from, let's say, the Byzantine period, or from is an icon from the Eastern Church, or that piece of art clearly painted in the 20th century, we might say. As soon as you begin to know anything about art, it's the same with music. You can go to a concert, and if you know anything about music, you can say that was written in the 1850s, that was written in the 1920s, that was written in 1650, and so on. There is a progression, and no matter how creative an artist is, they will express their creativity in a way which tells you an enormous amount about the culture from which they have come. So art is not simply in a vacuum. And Schaeffer makes the point here that the art shows us the general worldview of an age. It also displays people's religious thinking as well. And he gives a couple of examples from theology. He mentions, for example, a Catholic illustration by a painter, Hans Boldung, of Christ in the stable. And you've got the baby Christ in the stable, and in that picture, the light is emanating from the baby. There's no other source of light. There's no light coming in through a window or from a lantern or anything like that. And that tells you something about a Catholic theology of the incarnation of the person of Christ. He says, if you look at Rembrandt's paintings of Christ, and Rembrandt was a Protestant influenced by the Reformation, they're very different. But if you look at his nativity scenes, for example, the baby Christ is a normal human baby. He's really human. He isn't flooded light coming out of himself. The glory of his divinity is veiled. He has emptied himself, as Paul says. So wherever you see a painting of Christ, in Christ's lifetime, Christ is an ordinary human person. And a light in the picture comes some other source of light. He uses the illustration of Joseph holding a lantern, which is casting light on the baby's face. He says the only time you see Rembrandt painting Christ with light coming from himself is after the resurrection. And in fact, we've got the painting here, which Larry brought along for us. I don't know if you can see it from there. We could pass it around. This is Christ with the disciples he met on the Emmaus Road. And in this picture, Christ is, you can see the light is actually coming from Christ in the picture. It's also coming from the window in Rembrandt's picture, so there's real light as well, ordinary light coming from the sun through the window, but there's also a real light, a genuine light coming from Christ himself. And that reflects Rembrandt's theology, that is Schaeffer's point, because he knows that Christ, after his resurrection, is glorified, as Jesus himself said to the disciples, that some of them would not taste death until they'd seen the kingdom of God coming in power. And that's what Rembrandt is illustrating in that painting. Well, he gives another example of how Rembrandt's theology is reflected in his painting. And that's that wonderful painting some of you may be familiar with, and it became one of Schaeffer's favorite examples, which he was to refer to over and over again through the years. It's one of his favorite paintings. And that is Rembrandt's painting of the erection of the cross. Christ has been nailed on the cross, and now the cross is being lifted up to be put in its hole in the ground. And if you look at the painting closely, you'll see that the person, one of the people who's lifting the cross, is wearing a Dutch painter's cap, and is in fact Rembrandt himself. It's a really marvelous painting, and Rembrandt is saying in the clearest possible way that his sin is responsible for the death of Christ. It's a really marvelous painting, that Christ was dying because of his sins. So Schaeffer just uses these as illustrations of how theology is reflected in art of every kind. He then goes on in the article to discuss modern art. He wants to encourage Christians to begin to take modern art more seriously. He starts off with a discussion of some of the techniques. His point is that many people reject modern art because they will say it's distorted, it's unrealistic, it's so bizarre, it's so different, it's so experimental that I really don't relate to it at all. And he starts off by pointing out that some of the techniques that modern art uses are not modern at all, that all artists throughout history have used them. He gives examples. The first example is the distortion of reality to heighten effect. He gives some interesting examples there. One of the Acropolis, and this is a fascinating one, where the Greeks built the Acropolis with slanted lines. They're not in perfect perspective. It wasn't built absolutely square. It creates an effect of heightening its size and its lines. Well, he gives another example from El Greco, and probably many of you have seen paintings by El Greco, where particularly the figure of Christ, when he's suffering, is enormously elongated. And it heightens the effect of suffering that you experience when you're looking at the picture. So he says, the distortion of reality to heighten an effect has always been used by artists. The second and third things he points out are the way time and space may be changed in order to communicate something. And this has always been true in the arts. It's not just in modern art that you see time, if you like, telescoped, or that you see something which is an abnormal relationship of things in space to each other. He gives several examples of paintings where you see several events of a person's life at different times put together in order to tell you something about the person. So you've got different times and different space put into the same painting. Now we may say there's something different in some modern art, because sometimes when time and space are distorted in modern art, they're trying to say something rather different, and that is that everything is relative, coming back to what we were talking about, Einstein's theory of relativity. The fourth thing that he mentions, which is common to modern art and earlier art, is the use of the spectacular and unusual to gain effect for its own sake. And he gives examples from Gertrude Stein and a rather amusing one from Picasso. I think he rather changed his views on Picasso later on. He doesn't speak very favorably about him here. He's saying that in modern art, and this isn't completely new, you get people doing spectacular, unusual things, novel things, simply to create an effect. When he speaks of Gertrude Stein, he's talking about somebody who just didn't use normal syntax in her poetry. But you could think of some modern examples of this. Probably all of you have heard of this guy who goes around wrapping up buildings and even bits of the California coastline and mountains and forests and so on. Well, here is a guy, he has found a technique which makes money. He has found something spectacular to do, which is unusual. One couldn't really call it art. But it certainly made him a living. Now he says the spectacular is not something new in modern art. There's just simply perhaps more of it, we may say. I remember one of the worst examples I've ever seen was I went to an exhibition in London a couple of years ago at the Whitworth Gallery. It's right near Waterloo Station. If you ever go to London, it often has good exhibitions in there, but this particular one was really awful. And one of the pieces was called The Artist's Breath, and all it was a collapsed balloon just sitting on a little wooden block. But that was the piece of art. Now somebody there has come up with a novel idea, but you can hardly call it great art. And I think that's one of the problems we face, that it's very easy for Christians to dismiss modern art because there is so much of people just doing the spectacular, doing something novel, and people can just look at it and say, well, it's all like that, none of it is worth looking at it. But it is important not to dismiss it like that, because there's always been artists like that who've done spectacular things. The fifth thing he points out is that some modern art is experimentation in line and color and materials. And sometimes this is, and he gives the illustration of Scandinavian design, where some of what was put on display in fine art museums was in fact drawings and experiments which were done in relationship with the development of designs for furniture and buildings in the new Scandinavian design. And he suggests that really that should be thought of as applied art rather than belonging in a museum of fine arts. And there is a lot of modern art which is like that. You can go in almost any modern art museum now and you will find, for example, examples of computer designs. They're now very popular. Now, I don't think one can really call those fine art. They're more like, he says here, they are applied art. They're examples of experimentation with techniques that are available through the new technology. But beyond this, and this is where he really gets to the heart of the article, he wants to really look at what modern art is actually doing. And he says it's very important that Christians don't respond to modern art by saying it means nothing. That it means nothing. He suggests that Christians ought to attempt to understand modern art. He says our general response, the general response of the Christian, is simply to withdraw from modern art and to say we don't like it, we don't immediately understand it, so we don't want to have anything to do with it. And he says, suggests, no, we have got to be prepared to try to understand it, because then we understand something about the people among whom we live. Artists are like prophets of a doomed world. And modern art has been like that. It's been like a series of prophecies of what is happening in our culture. Because artists are often very sensitive ahead of time to the direction in which a culture is going. So here's Schaefer pleading 40 years ago for Christians to be sensitive to modern art if we actually want to understand the culture in which we're living. There are several points I want to make here about this. The first is simply this that I've already said, that we need, as we look at modern art, we can begin to understand where people are at, where our culture is at. And there are several points that he makes. That in modern art, in much modern art, we see the loss of meaning and certainty. That loss of meaning and certainty, which we've already thought about in the context of the general culture, is expressed in a very dramatic way in much modern art. Whether we're thinking about painting, sculpture, music, theatre, the novel, short stories, or whatever. But the modern artist is often presenting to us a world which is chaotic, a world where there is unrelatedness rather than relatedness, a sense of nightmare. And in this we see a cry of lostness and desperation. Now later on Schaefer would use examples from modern film. You can think of Bergman's film The Silence, or The Hour of the Wolf, or Persona. Several of Bergman's films have the quality of a nightmare, most clearly. You feel like you're in a really bad dream when you're watching one of his films. He would also use the example later of John Cage, who purposely made his music which was chance music. I remember going to a lecture of his here in St. Louis 20 years ago, where he actually produced on stage some chance music. It was really quite extraordinary because he had, at that time, of course, computers are very much bigger than they are now, and he had this enormous computer, which today I suppose would be in a little box this size, but it took up a space about 10 feet long and 3 feet deep, and it was about 8 feet high, and he had a technician with him, in order to help him produce this chance music. I just thought it was a tremendous irony for a start anyway, that in order to get totally unrelated sounds, he had to have this extraordinarily complicated mathematical and technical machine there, which is exactly the opposite of a piece of chance, but he didn't appear to see the total discontinuity there. But it was, if you've ever listened to any of John Cage's music, he very purposely produces music where the sounds have no melody, they have no formal structure, there is no particular relationship between the pieces, bits of noise that you hear. In the film How Shall We Then Live, very much later, Schaeffer actually had a scene of John Cage playing one of his pieces, and you may remember it. It's a piece for closed piano. And John Cage comes out, there's a piano in the street, and he comes out and he sets an alarm clock and sits down at the piano, sets the alarm clock for 2 minutes, and he closes the lid of the piano, and he just sits there in absolute silence. And then when the 2 minutes is up, he turns off the alarm and opens up the piano again and stands up, and everybody applauds. And that was his piece of music. He wrote another piece for 12 radio stations, I think it was, where you had to tune them arbitrarily to different stations and play them all at the same time. Or another piece of his, which I saw on television, this is just a couple of years ago in Britain, he produced a piece of music, and sort of like an opera, in which the words were taken from James Joyce's Ulysses, and his directions, if you know anything about that novel, I mean, it's an extraordinary novel anyway, where there is a breakdown of normal syntax totally in the novel, but his directions for the sound were something like, you had to take the center word on the eighth line of every page through the book, and that's how the text of the opera was made up. In other words, words that bear no relationship to each other at all, except that they occur in this book. And then there was various music for sitar and various other instruments. But Cage, in his music, is a perfect illustration of what Schaeffer is speaking about here, about the loss of meaning, the loss of certainty, about chaos and unrelatedness. And Cage understood that very well, that he was creating music which was saying that we are living in a chance universe. We are a product of chance, everything around us is a product of chance, and my music will be a product of chance in order to show that. So this is one thing that we see in a great deal of modern art, the loss of meaning and certainty. You can think of plays like Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, which some of you may be familiar with, or another one of his Happy Days, which is a play where you've got a person up to their waist in a rubbish heap, basically, and all they have is a toothbrush, I think it is, and some toothpaste, and you have this kind of monologue going on. And a final one of his called Breath, where he reached the very end of what he could say, where all the play was three sounds. A child, a baby crying, the sound of a couple copulating, and then the sound of somebody dying, and there are no words at all. That's where Beckett came to in the end, and you get this sense of total absurdity in a great deal of modern art, whether it's music, films, theatre, or whatever it is. Thinking of this under point one here, the understanding of where people are at, a second thing that Schaeffer mentions that we see in modern art is the expression of the idea that civilization is only a veneer. Civilization is only a veneer. That underneath that veneer is the primitive and the animal, and the savage. And again, we see that in a great deal of modern art, expressions of primitivism. There was a whole point where French art was very much modeled on primitivism. You can think of some of the work of Picasso and of Gauguin too, with the glorification of the savage, of the primitive. But not only a civilization of Anir, but that artistic conventions are also a veneer, and modern art felt free to break totally with the conventions of the past because it saw them as simply a veneer produced by the civilization from which they came. That all the normal canons of art can break down completely once you regard civilization and culture simply as a kind of veneer. And so in modern art, one of the things we see as that is recognized is what you could call the skull beneath the skin. And that's not a modern phrase, that's from Webster early 17th century. But you see the skull beneath the skin. So in modern art, over and over again, you're seeing something ugly, evil, savage underneath the veneer of civilization. I remember an exhibition that was here in St. Louis, and I think it was de Kooning, was down at the art gallery, and he expressed this in a very dramatic way. You would go in, and he had these absolutely beautiful things, and you would want to reach out your hand and touch them. I remember one, it was like a jewel box. It was very beautiful, and when you put your hand down to touch it, it was filled with very sharp pins, which were almost invisible. And it was only when you got very close that you realized that they were there, that there is this surface of beauty, and then behind that is pain and suffering and violence. And many of his pieces were like that. The appearance of beauty, the appearance of civilization, but underneath something very, very sharp and painful and hurting. And also the other thing we see, the civilization as a veneer, is you often see that the animal behind the human. In many modern paintings, you see human beings presented under the form of animals. Again, the human is simply a veneer over the animal from which man is supposed to have developed. And related to that is that personality has no basis. This would be a third point here under number one, that personality has no basis. So in a great deal of modern art, you see the breakdown of the human. I've seen art exhibitions in which human beings are presented as machines. I remember a very striking one where in place of a person's eyes, there were watches. These were in some statues. And the idea is that everything that's going on inside a person is simply mechanical. There isn't a real human being there. Or human beings just made of bits of old rubbish, which has been thrown away. Again, making the same kind of statement. Or if you think of Giacometti's statues, they're always individual human beings in total isolation from each other. They're always walking off in different directions, all these elongated figures who have no human relationships at all. So the acknowledgement that human personality has no basis, that ultimately we come from the impersonal, that the things we regard as precious, love and relationships, individual significance, our uniqueness from the animals and from the mechanical, that just rests on a kind of lie, that ultimately this is not true. So the human is broken down. And fourthly, here we see that morality is only a social convention. And you get that very frequently in films. I mentioned last week Blow Up. It would be a very good example of that, where morality, whether in terms of sexual morality or regarding murder as murder, is clearly declared to be simply a social convention. It doesn't rest on any final difference, any final distinction between good and evil. Morality has no solid foundation. And everything is decaying, finally, we may say. The theme of decay, of that of fragmentation, of decay and fragmentation, is repeated over and over in a great deal of modern art. So this is the first point that Schaeffer is making. As we look at modern art, not all of modern art, of course, I'm making some generalizations here, just as he does, but as we look at modern art, it gives us some understanding about where our culture is at. Secondly, he makes the point that modern art, the modern arts, are more honest than modern theology. He says that basically modern theology and the modern arts have the same message, but the artists are more honest than the theologians. They have the same message of uncertainty, of a loss of meaning, of the relative, some of the things we looked at last time and the time before, but even though they believe the same thing ultimately, that human significance rests on a void, that there is ultimately no meaning, they carry on using God words, whereas the artist is much more honest and portrays reality as he really sees it and knows it. And I quoted in one of my other classes, but I'll quote it here again, the discussion between Jaspers and Bultmann. Jaspers, the Swiss existentialist, who used to tell his students that if they took his lectures seriously, they would have to recognize that they may end up committing suicide, because he regarded that as one of the real options that his students were left with when they understood how clearly he regarded life as completely meaningless. But he had a debate once with Rudolf Bultmann, the very radical neo-orthodox theologian, and at the end of the debate he said to Bultmann, "Surely you and I are saying just the same thing." And Bultmann replied, "Yes, we are. Yes, we are saying the same thing. Ultimately, reality is completely absurd." And Jaspers said to him, "Why then all this God language? Why all this talk about Christianity and encountering Christ and faith?" And Bultmann said, "Because I have to have something to say to people in need." And Schaeffer's point here is really profound. He's saying that the artists who portray life as a nightmare are being much more honest than the modern theologians who think it's a nightmare but still carry on preaching the gospel as if it were true, when they don't really believe that it is. That modern theology has the illusion of meaning but with no basis. Modern art recognizes there is no meaning and tells you quite honestly, and Schaeffer suggests that this has far more integrity to it, to be straight about the fact that life is absurd, that the human has no foundation, that there is no basis for morality, that the skull is only just beneath the skin. The third point that Schaeffer makes as he thinks about modern art and the Christian understanding it is this: but in the past, men who have rejected Christianity have been inconsistent, that they have rejected the biblical message about God and about Christ and about our being called to live under God's word, under his authority, but they have tried to keep inconsistently the biblical world, to think that you can have a moral society, an ordered society, a meaningful society without God and without Christ. But that this was in a way kind of dishonest, and it was inconsistent. It was a form of cheating to believe that you could have all the results of Christianity without having Christianity itself. That you could have the relationships, the moral framework that it gives, the sense of meaning and certainty, the basis for rationality, but you could just dispense with God as a kind of outmoded idea. And he says in modern art what you see is the recognition, the more consistent recognition, that if you're going to get rid of God, you have to be prepared to let go of everything else that comes with him. Rationality, meaning to the individual life, a basis for morality, a basis for an ordered society, and so on. The modern artist In other words, it's like the existentialist who says, let's be serious about what it means that God is dead. And Schaefer puts it this way, it's as though God has released men to experience the consequences of their rebellion. What he's doing, in a way, though he doesn't tie it into Romans 1, is he is making the point that Paul makes in Romans 1, that when people refuse to have God in their knowledge, when they suppress the truth of God, then God gives them over to all the things that Paul says he gives them over to, that is, a debased mind, to immorality, to the breakdown of every kind of social convention. And as you read Romans 1, it's like a prophecy of our society, which has turned away from God and then lives to experience its results. And some of it very dramatically so. You can think about the expression about homosexuality in Romans 1, about sowing in themselves the seeds of their own destruction, and how that has been so appallingly fulfilled in our culture with AIDS and the spread of every other kind of venereal disease. That if we turn away from God and refuse to have him in our knowledge, that we then have to work out in time the consequences of what that rebellion will mean in our everyday life. And this is the point that Schaefer is making, that whereas in the past people rejected Christianity but still tried to hold on to what it gave, today what we see in modern art is people who've rejected Christianity and are trying to be consistent to what it means, are really beginning to experience in their art the result of the rejection of God. And I would say that when he made this statement back in the 40s, back in the late 40s and early 50s, that in a way it was a kind of prophetic statement. I think there were very few Christians who were understanding this at the time, that modern art was really a sort of prophecy of what is happening in our whole culture. Most Christians just simply dismissed it out of hand and said, I don't understand it, it's irrational, it doesn't make sense, it isn't beautiful, I can't make it mean anything, therefore we will just ignore it and we will go our own way. But he was saying we really need to look at this because it's telling us what is happening in our culture as a whole. Because artists are, if you like, generally speaking, on the front wave of a civilization as it moves forward. But the whole of the rest of the culture is being dragged along behind in the undertow from that wave. And today we see it. The things that the artists were writing and painting and putting into their music 40 or 50 years ago are now an everyday part of our society. An everyday part of the breakdown of the culture in which we live, that we see all around us. Now, the fourth point he makes is this, that if we make an effort to understand the drift of our age, and art provides that a window into it, to that understanding, we may protect ourselves against the drift of our age. That the Christian who says, oh, I can't be bothered to understand what's happening, it's not worth looking at it, is much more likely actually to be carried along behind the wave. That if we don't think about what is happening in our culture, we often have no means of resisting the direction in which it's going. That it's only as we arm ourselves by understanding it that we can stand up against it. We could apply this in many, many areas. The most obvious one is materialism. If we don't think carefully about the materialism of our culture, we just get washed away with it. It's only as we understand it that we can stand up against it. Now, it's true in every area, and Schaefer is applying this to the whole drift of our age towards meaningless, towards the breakdown of morality and so on, as it's reflected in modern art. The fifth point he makes is this, that as we understand modern art, we will have a point of contact to communicate with the people of our age. He just says quite simply that there are many people whom we may reach for Christ far better if we really understand where they're coming from. He says there are many people whom we can reach for Christ far better if we have an understanding of these things which exhibit the basic modern viewpoint, and therefore we can understand something of that by which today's men are bound, not only in spiritual darkness, but in an intellectual and emotional darkness, which ultimately are rooted in and spring from that spiritual darkness. It's the very end of the article, page 169. So that it gives us a point of contact, that if we see and hear and understand the same things that people around us are seeing and hearing and understanding, we have a better possibility of communicating with people. So these are the major points that he makes in this article. I just want to add a couple of final comments here. It has been sort of fashionable to criticize Schaeffer as what you might call a culture vulture. I've certainly heard people say that about him and read things written about him like that. He's been dismissed by some people in that way. They've said, well, he's not a professional art critic. He had no proper training. He never went to school to study the arts at all. He had no formal training. So we must regard him simply as a culture vulture, somebody who is commenting on art because it was a fashionable thing to do, kind of trendy, or because it's clever to, it appears to be intellectual to make comments on modern art. Many times I've seen him dismissed any of the comments he makes about the arts simply because he doesn't have a professional training and the assumption that he is a sort of culture vulture. Of course, one can point out mistakes that he made sometimes in his criticism because he wasn't professionally trained. But it doesn't help to dismiss him as a kind of semi-literate artistic philistine, which people sometimes do. He did try to really understand things himself, and he had behind many of his comments the professional understanding of Hans Ruckmacher, because they spent many, many hours over the years in discussion together about the kinds of things that Schaeffer was saying about the arts. But in response to that criticism that he was a culture vulture, let me make several points. One, he was genuinely interested in art. He was genuinely interested in art. He really delighted in seeing things and hearing things and watching things that were created by other human beings, because he saw it as a wonderful expression of what it means that human beings are made in the image of God, to see their creativity. Secondly, he was very anxious to understand the people of our day. And he quite rightly saw that modern art, the modern arts, are often the very best way to understand where people are at. Thirdly, he genuinely respected the honesty of the consistency which you see in a lot of modern art, which becomes like a kind of howl or a cry of desperation. You can think of Francis Bacon's paintings, for example. Some of you may have seen some of them. There's one of his where he has a cardinal, I think it is, who's in a glass cage. And he is howling. There's this appalling howl on his face. All you can really see is a howl. There's no more of the head really properly visible. And many of Francis Bacon's paintings are like that. They have a nightmarish quality. They demonstrate this tremendous anguish of human beings at facing life. And Schaeffer really respected the honesty of the consistency that without God, life really becomes like that. That honesty expressed in the fragmentation of meaning and of form. Because that's one of the unique things about modern art. In expressing its message, it had to express it as if it was going to do it with any artistic integrity, with a fragmentation of form as well. You can't really paint a message of total absurdity as if you were still painting something beautiful. because you're saying it isn't beautiful. And the form reflects that breakdown of meaning, reflects that fragmentation of understanding. Fourthly, he was aware of the danger to the church of not being sensitive to what's happening in the culture round about. And finally, I think this is the most important thing, he had a tremendous compassion to communicate to people. He wasn't interested in going to see things just because people would think that he was clever. He had a tremendous compassion to communicate to people. And God used that over and over and over again. Because the young people who flowed to Le Brie in Switzerland over the years saw in him somebody who really understood what they were experiencing and understood the culture in which they were living and which was shaping the way they thought. They didn't regard him as somebody who was trying to be trendy. They saw a man who was seeking to have a compassionate understanding of where they were at and to answer the questions and needs and struggles that are raised so acutely in so much of modern art. And a final comment here on it, I would say this. Sometimes people have thought that Schaeffer was just simply being negative about modern art, but he wasn't at all. When he speaks in what appears to be a negative way, he is not dismissing what is said, what is communicated in modern art. He is really rather simply weeping for the lostness of the people who produce these things, which is expressed so clearly in this work. So his negative comments are not dismissal. It's the same with Ruckmacher. Sometimes, like in his book on Modern Art and the Death of a Culture, it's a wonderful book. People have felt that he was just being negative. He wasn't being negative at all in his dismissing kind of sense. He was more weeping for what that art expresses. If this is part of the Reformed tradition, why is it so lacking in the Reformed tradition today? Why is there so little encouragement to young Christians to be involved in the arts and in other kind of cultural areas like that? I would say that it's partly because the term Reformed in the United States has taken on a narrower meaning than it had historically. If you were to ask anybody in Holland or Switzerland what it meant to be Reformed, they would reply to you that to be Reformed means to understand that the whole of life comes under the authority of God, that God is the creator of all things, that he calls us to understand that everything we do, everything we think, everything we say belongs to God, that God's sovereignty has to be understood as God's lordship over everything, and that he calls us as his servants to manifest that lordship over everything. This is one of the central themes of Calvinism historically, one of the great contributions that Calvin made. There's a wonderful book on this by Abraham Kuyper, on that contribution of Calvin. It was the unique contribution that Calvin made at the Reformation. He made other unique contributions as well, but particularly that one, the recognition that the whole of culture, the whole of society, the whole of life is to come under the authority of Christ. Now that has always been a central part of the Reformed tradition. In the United States, I think particularly in this century, perhaps particularly in the last 40 or 50 years, Reformed has tended to take on the narrower meaning of a stress on the sovereignty of God in the sense of God as sovereign in salvation through election. That has always been a part of Reformed theology too, but it's simply been one part of that emphasis on the lordship, on the sovereignty of God. Not seen as the central part or the simple and only distinctive of what being Reformed is. So if you ask somebody from the Anglo-Saxon world, well, from Britain or America, what is Reformed, they will probably say an emphasis on the grace of God in salvation. If you ask somebody from the continent, they will say the emphasis of the lordship of Christ over the whole of life, Now, why has this happened? Why has there been this sort of retreat from that traditional Reformed understanding? I think the simple reason for it is exactly what Schaeffer's getting at in this article. That often Christians don't understand what's happening in our modern culture, so their response is to retreat from it. We don't understand what's happening, we don't like what's happening, so we will retreat from it into our Christian subculture. We're frightened of what it will do to us and our children, so we will simply withdraw from the life of the general culture. And we will leave the general culture to the devil and all his works, to the world. And we will develop our own Christian art and our own Christian music. And you see that today. You can turn on Christian television stations, Christian radio stations, you have Christian pop music, you have every kind of Christian music, you have Christian art, but the only people who ever see it are Christians. The only people who ever listen to it are Christians. It's not a contribution to the general culture. It's not really an acknowledgement of the Lordship of Christ over the whole of life. It is simply a subculture trying to be completely self-sufficient on the side to avoid having contact with the world. God's challenge in his word is that we actually be light in the world and salt in the earth, not in the subculture. And I think it's a very serious mistake we've made in withdrawing. You know, the challenge to every Christian church, to every Christian school of every level, to every Christian institution, is that we should be particularly Reformed ones who have had this emphasis, which is so thoroughly biblical, that the whole of life belongs to God. The challenge to us is to be preparing people to make a contribution in the general culture, not in our subculture. Often in our subculture, the standards are very poor, standards which wouldn't be acceptable for one moment out in the general culture. You know, Frankie wrote his book, it's a bit overheavy, Addicted to Mediocrity, but this was the point that he was making, Frankie Schaeffer, that we, by retreating from the general culture, have been able to substitute well-meaning for quality. And if we were involved in the general culture, nobody would buy the things that we produce very often. Now, I think Schaeffer saw this very clearly. He saw that this was a part of the Reformed tradition, this emphasis on understanding and being involved in and making a contribution to the general culture, that it isn't helpful to get caught in a side stream, in a tributary that's flowing off in some other direction of its own, because Christ has called us to serve him here in the world. That is his calling to us. And I think it's tremendously important that we recognize that calling and then commit ourselves to it and our families to it and our churches to it and all of our Christian institutions to it. Now, I can understand why people are afraid of our culture. So I'm not being critical on that level. But I would say that it's simply a matter of having confidence in the power and grace of God. As those who are Reformed, above all people, we ought to have confidence in the power and in the Lordship of Christ, which enables us to actually go out into the general culture and set up signs there of his kingdom, rather than hiding our light under a cover, which is what we do. Because that's what God calls us to do. Christ came and lived in the world, you know, and was seen in the world, and he calls us to be. You know, we don't need to be afraid. We need to fear God. That's what Jesus said. That's what Scripture says. Fear God. Not the devil, not the world, but fear God. He's the one we fear most of all. And if we fear him, then we're prepared to obey him by serving him, bringing the whole of life under him, under his authority, out in the world. Now, in fact, just practically, Schaeffer and Ruckmacher had an enormous impact in Britain, for example. They began to speak in the 50s and 60s in Britain into a context where evangelicals of all stripes, including Reformed evangelicals, had retreated totally from the general culture. It was considered completely worldly in the 50s and in the 60s for young Christians to go into any area of the arts. It was considered an unspiritual, carnal thing to do. You know, any Christian who wanted to become a painter or a ballet dancer or an opera singer or an actor or a writer or a musician, unless it was simply sacred music or something sacred off in a corner, everybody who did was regarded as being unspiritual and not really devoted to Christ. And as Schaeffer and Ruckmacher came to England and did quite a lot of speaking there in colleges and universities and high schools and to groups of Christian students here and there, that it had an enormous impact under the grace of God. And there was a change, not in the older generation, but in the younger generation. And a whole generation of young Christians started going into all the fields of the arts and have really begun to make a contribution. And Steve Turner is one of the consequences of that. It was very moving, actually, at Ruckmacher's memorial service and Schaeffer's memorial service in London, which were both held at All Souls, Langham Place. And I had the privilege of being asked to speak at both of those. But at both of them, various people came forward who were involved in the arts in Britain. And every single one of them said, you know, the reason I am a poet, the reason I am a singer, the reason I am a writer is because Schaeffer or Ruckmacher encouraged me to be and told me that it wasn't a worldly thing to do. And here you have people who are really making a contribution and who are being read in the general culture as well as, or seen in the general culture as well as by Christians. And that is where we have to seek to make a contribution. And if that can happen in Britain, where you've got less than 5% of the population is evangelical, it can certainly happen here, where probably far more than 5% of the population is reformed, and a huge percentage of the population is evangelical. We really need, I think, to take Schaeffer's challenge seriously.